I want to encourage you to open your Bible, or if you have an electronic Bible, to turn it on and go to Leviticus chapter 19. I'm going to read the first 18 verses. In the law of God here, I want us to hear the voice of God. Leviticus 19, I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Leviticus 19. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves any gods cast of metal. I am the Lord your God. When you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, you shall offer it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it or on the day after, and anything left over until the third day shall be burned up with fire. If it is eaten at all on the third day, it is tainted. It will not be accepted. And everyone who eats it shall bear his iniquity, because he has profaned what is holy to the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after you harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. You shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely. You shall not lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Lord. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." I was 23, and I was freshly installed. That's the word that they love to use in Baptist circles. It's like you're fastened or something. I was freshly installed as the solo pastor of a little congregation of about 40 people in rural northwestern Ontario. The church had seen much better days. I'd once had a thriving Sunday school, and it now had been reduced to a handful of children. The Sunday services, which had once been filled with songs of praise, actually were filled with strife and conflict. In fact, it wasn't shocking for shouting arguments to break out on a Sunday morning. The times afterwards where it should have been filled with coffee and laughter were filled with turf wars and fights about where clocks would go on walls and who put what on the paneled walls in the basement. On the Sunday that I was preaching for call, so if you understand, this is the picture of the church, by the way. On the Sunday that I was preaching for call, it was an amazing experience. This is your job interview. This is where you're selling yourself to them and they're selling themselves to you. I had preached that morning, 23, I'm not that good, and it's 40 people, and I gave them everything I had. And at the end of the service, we went downstairs where there was a Q&A time. As I excused myself for a moment to get a refreshment, I went to the corner where there was some refreshment, some dessert. I was quickly finding the pie, and that's what I do when I go to a church. And as I found the pie, a man, mid-60s, big, burly, tough voice, cornered me, got me into the corner. I had the pie between him and me, and as I was standing there, he said to me, "Young man, if you're going to come to this church, there are two sides, and you better know which side you're on." I'll take the job. So I did. It was quite an insane experience, if you can only imagine. My first Sunday, which is actually 18 years ago this week, was nothing what I thought pastoral ministry would be like. This dysfunctional, rowdy, beat up, redneckish kind of church, which I fit in really well because I was from northwestern Ontario and a redneck myself. It was filled with grandparents, people that were, they could have been older than my grandparents. In many cases, they could have been grandparents to my grandparents. The church was filled with that, and I discovered a church family that would end up being my home and my family for almost 9 years. Now, what happens so that that becomes a family when you're cornered at the pie table, when someone threatens you, that you can actually become a family? How does that work? On my first Sunday, a new family attended. They had attended previously, probably some 10, 12 years prior to my arrival. They had been former missionaries to Cote d'Ivoire, medical missionaries. And during their time on the missions field, Phil and his wife Karen had been beat up. They had been badly hurt. They were disappointed and had left the mission with great disappointment and pain. And what began as a young pastor trying to figure out how to shepherd a rowdy bunch of sheep who didn't really want to be shepherded, and a former missionary who was burnt out by abusive power and authority, it actually became a foundation for me understanding Leviticus 19. The law that was given to Israel was not something that was punitive. It's wrong to pit the law against grace. If we rightly understand Israel, we remember that they were a ragtag, beat-up kind of group. They had come out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage and slavery. They were the kind of people who had known nothing but generations of abuse, hardship, demands. A nation that had faced near genocide as their people were being exterminated. And when genocide hadn't beaten them down and gotten them out, God had rescued and delivered them by a child who was rescued in a little ark of a basket in the Nile River to bring about a new creation just like Moses had entered. And anyone who has known abusive authority and dysfunctional family environments and toxic religion knows that it is not natural to come out of that environment and be the most loving person. Nor is it natural to be a loving people when that's what you've known. How do you become a loving, generous, gracious people when all you have known is dysfunction and hardship or abuse or torture or sin, and all those things are the norm? How do you become the kind of people that love your neighbor as you love yourself? Well, Leviticus 19 is what I would call the Old Testament Sermon on the Mount. And it actually shows us a path forward for how broken people, people destroyed and wrecked and ruined by sin, a sinful world, can not only be healed by God, but be healing agents in a world that needs the love of God. So how is it then that we encounter and experience and then become the people who display the love of God to the world? Well, I want you to see, first of all, from verses 1 and 2, the Lord is holy. And so the command for us then is, be holy. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Throughout this chapter, 16 times the refrain comes, I am the Lord, or I am the Lord your God. At the end of this chapter, in verse 36, it ends, verse 36, it says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. This is the same covenantal language that is used at the very beginning of the Ten Commandments. God who defines himself, who acknowledges who he is, who establishes a relationship with his people, tells them who he is and how he acts. I am the Lord your God. I am Yahweh, the covenant-keeping, the never-breaking promise-keeping, always faithful-keeping to my promises God. And if that's the kind of God I am, I'm also the God who brought you out of slavery, brought you out of bondage. And so the chapter begins and it ends with these bookends, if you would. It's the pieces that kind of hold all the books in so that they don't fall off the shelf. It's the defining center, or the defining outlying edges of this chapter. I am the Lord your God. And it reminds us of, before anything else, that God has first and foremost acted on our behalf. This is grace. God who acts first and foremost on our behalf is a God who acts in grace. And before he gives us any command, any ethical demand, any requirement, he always grounds it and reminds us of who he is. And so when Israel had come out of Egypt, all they had known, slavery, mistreatment, harsh conditions, and demands. And if they were to act any differently than the Egyptians or how they had been treated, they needed an example to live by. Now, it's not enough to say, we're not going to act like those Egyptians. There's a certain amount of self-righteousness that comes with that when we say, we're not going to act like they act. You need something that's unique, something that's given to you so that you can know how to live and follow and obey God. And so God would enable them to live as his chosen, set-apart, holy people, a holy nation, a royal priesthood. And God had given them a pattern, his rescue, his deliverance, his victory and power, which redeemed a people in love and mercy. You see, God understands that what we need is we need a positive example that gets our eyes moving forward and gets us off of the poor example. How many parents say, I am never going to do what my mom and dad did? And then one day, all of a sudden, your child is disobedient, and out of your mouth, you hear either your father or your mother, and you're shocked. How is it possible? I was never going to say that. And my mother just seems to have come right through my tongue, and now I'm hearing her right in the presence of everyone. It can be easy to see the faults of our parents and to go, I won't be like that. But unless you have something that you set your eyes toward, this is what I'm going to become, you will always revert back to the ways that you despise. What you fix your eyes on, you will become like. And so it's always important that you not just say, this is what I don't want to be, but this is what I want to be. And God in his grace gives us what is not acceptable, Egypt, bondage, slavery, and he sets forth the example by his liberation and rescuing redemption by showing us what grace looks like. And so the chapter begins and it ends with this identification of God, a holy, rescuing God. It's foundational to everything else. And being holy then is what is described. You shall be holy as the Lord your God is holy. What does it mean then to be holy? We need to understand this before we even talk about love. Because if we're going to understand love rightly, we need to understand holiness. Holiness has two concepts to it. The first is the concept of being devoted or set apart. It has this idea of fully committed to another, which is why when people get married, we call it holy matrimony. I am devoted to this person to whom I make vows. I am set apart. This relationship is unique. It is unlike any other. I am fully committed to this person. And so because a man and a woman devote themselves to one another, they set themselves apart from all others, forsaking all others, which is the language that is often used in a marriage ceremony. It is the same kind of picture of a God who is devoted, who is set apart, who is unique from his creation, but fully devoted to his creation's good. And so this God who is fully devoted to his people's good is also a God who is pure, without fault, without blemish, without stain. He is morally pure. He is ethically pure. He is in every way pure. He is pureness which defines pure. Now, the reason we talk about holiness before we talk about love is for a very simple reason. The foundation for any kind of love is devotion and purity. Before I can love, I need to know that someone loves me. Before I am able to be free to love and to sacrifice and to give, I must have known that same type of love. And so when I know that the God of the universe is fully committed to my good and my welfare, that he would send his one and only Son for my good, he would sacrifice all, that heaven and earth would move for my good, when I experience existentially that radical love of God, how can I not love this God who has devoted himself to my good? It is the foundation for me not only to emulate that desire and to pass it on, but to experience it and to know the reality of it, that I'm freed to love. So when God commands us to be holy, it's first rooted in his purity and his devotion to us. This is why when Peter, the apostle, read the book of Leviticus, which he faithfully did, we know, because when he writes his letter in 1 Peter, he quotes the words from this chapter. He writes and he says in 1 Peter 1, verses 14 to 16, "As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" Just as anyone who gets married understands that they no longer think about themselves as the center of the universe, that if you're going to be late, that it is right and honorable to let your spouse know when you'll be home or what kind of decisions are affecting your day, in the same way, when we understand God's devotion to us, it is right for us then to live in devotion to him. That we honor him. That we don't live our lives independent as though we can function on our own. God had intended Israel not to live on their own, but to understand that God's holiness was to make them a light to the nations. And in the same way, when we speak and act and think of God as being devoted to us and us devoted to him, then how can we not be a people who let our good deeds be known so that others would see our good deeds, as Matthew 5 says, Jesus says, and give glory to our Father in heaven? So in order to love, before we even get to verse 18, we must be devoted to God in the same kind of way that God is devoted to us. So, God is holy. Be holy. But the second thing is, the commands are good. So, if the commands are good, obey. Now, it seems pretty straightforward and logical, but we need to ask the question, what does a devoted person look like? Well, the chapter highlights what loyalty to God looks like. The commands reflect how we should live and how we should worship God in every day. And first through this chapter, the commands are rooted in verse 3 and following in the Ten Commandments. "I, the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt." Now he reiterates the commands that he gave in Exodus 20. The first, the first command that's mentioned in verse 3 is the fifth command. And the fifth command that is mentioned is actually reversed, interestingly. It's backwards. And it seems kind of strange, but very suited for this morning. Because the command that God gives is interrelated between loving God and loving neighbor. That there is no separation between the two. If you love God, as 1 John 4 says, you will love others. We heard that passage this morning. You cannot love God and hate your neighbor. If you love God, you will love your neighbor. The logical connection is there. The first command, then, which is mentioned in verse 3, is to honor and revere your mother and father. Interestingly, it's reversed. In the commands that are given in Exodus 20, it's honor your father and mother, and here it's honor your mother and your father, to revere them. If you love God, there is an understanding that you will revere, you will respect, you will honor the authority of your parents. When we understand that God has given authority for us to flourish and that we are to understand authority then as something that helps us, we don't then bristle against good, right, and godly authority. Now, I'm saying good, right, and godly authority for a reason, because people have a tendency to abuse and take advantage of authority. Just as mothers are mentioned here first, we don't know why, but in a time and age where women were not viewed with much respect in the surrounding culture around Israel, it is fascinating. It is fascinating that mothers are put first. Mothers, the shapers of society. Mothers, the one who would instill into their children a certain amount of ethic and teaching. Mothers who would spend the most time with their children in the early years, honored, respected. Even in the ancient world and today, being a mother is a high and noble calling. It is the task of preparing and shaping citizens for a world. It is no small task. That mothers who do their job well prepare and launch into the world people who make a difference. If there is one vocation in this world that we ought to celebrate and be thankful for, it is motherhood. It has shaped nations and moved kingdoms. And it has all been behind the scenes by moms who have been so mindful of their children. And as Paul says in Titus 2, it's not just physical mothers, biological mothers, but rather the New Testament also acknowledges that motherhood is something that is spiritual. Older women, Paul says in Titus 2, verses 2 through 4, that they should teach and instruct the younger women to love their husbands and children. Apparently that doesn't come naturally, especially when you have a disobedient child and you have a husband. Every man needs to be loved. And women, older women in the church, are to instruct and teach younger women how to love their husbands and children. It is this spiritual motherhood that the New Testament holds up, being clothed with sacrificial love, caring for those who are in need. And I am so thankful to God in our church for the spiritual mothers who serve. The women who have taken my girls under their wings and have mothered them in ways. The women of this church who open the Bible and teach other women how to understand the Bible. I'm thankful to God for these women who have played a vital role. And even when our earthly mothers have let us down, God has not left us without spiritual mothers in this world so that we would learn to love. And when we understand, as God gives earthly authority, and He gives it so that we can flourish and be loved and be cared for, we can see then in earthly relationships how God is working for our good. And the results then are that we love God and that we love others and we love God, which is why the fifth commandment, honor your mother and your father, is connected with the Sabbath commandment to honor God. That you cannot love God and not love neighbor, and you cannot love neighbor and reject God. The two are inextricably linked. Loving God and others are connected. And so the worship of God then automatically follows that if there is a right understanding of authority in the earthly realm, in the basic realm, when you understand that God gives authority of parents, which is to be, that authority is to be exercised for human flourishing and goodness, then we understand why worship is so inextricably linked. It's linked to our flourishing. Worship always involves our personal inner devotion and our community worship, which is why the offering that is mentioned here is the peace offering, an offering offered to God and a meal that is shared with the community. That love of God and love of neighbor are connected in this offering. That you cannot love God by just offering a gift at the altar and reject those around you. Rather, in this offering, this specific offering mentioned in verses 5 through 8, it is a community offering, an offering where you share and eat together in the presence and love of others and of God. And so Christians understand that our worship is both private and public. It is individual and it is communal. And so holiness, then, is not merely about worship. It involves worship, but it involves our interaction with others. And so verses 9 through 16, then, teach us that holiness means treating others with integrity. That we treat others with dignity and respect. So in verses 9 and 10, we see that the commands that are given, we are told here, it's the reaping, so all of our farmers are now wondering, do I have to leave the edges of my field, and what am I supposed to do about that? It's the principle, it's the moral principle of the law here that I think that we need to rightly understand. It is this essence of having integrity towards others and their dignity by caring for those who are poor and needy. And so those who owned land for harvesting crops were to leave some of the edges of their grain for those who were poor and needy, or their vineyards. They weren't to go over it a second time. There was to be this charitable way of people surviving. If death or destruction or famine or war had caused enormous hardship, there was no welfare system in the ancient world. This was the welfare system. You cared for your neighbor. You loved your neighbor. The act of welfare was done out of the generosity that God had so shown you, and so that spilled over. That charity was not motivated by legislation. It wasn't by taxation. But rather, the generosity, the goodness of God, which He had shown you, spilled forth into this desire to be a blessing to others. Which is why I think it's always better that charity comes not by taxation, but by the incentivization of being generous. That it flows out of a heart that has been changed and touched. And so while we have these commands, we ought to recognize that we are the kind of people who are quick to figure out how to help people live in integrity. The commands then go on in verses 11 and 12, and those commands are helping people to avoid temptation. I think they're connected to verses 9 and 10. That if you help a person in their poverty and in their difficulty, what are you doing but you are helping them to avoid the temptation to steal and to rob and to lie? That radical generosity ought to produce in people and move people towards an understanding of being full of integrity. And so just as the Ten Commandments tell us not to steal and lie and covet, God had intended His people to be those who help others with what we call as a church radical generosity. Our value, our middle value of 5, to be radically generous because God has been so radically generous to us. We want to help people avoid temptation. We want them to flee evil. And the way that we do that is by being generous. And so, I can't help but think of people in our church who have been so radically generous with their time and their talents and their resources, without any fanfare, without any notice, without any attention, going to Ronald McDonald House or Arcade or 100 other ways, without any program or without anybody insisting, people genuinely loving others who are in need. I'm thrilled that we can participate in this baby bottle campaign and help women who are often in a place of crisis. When they have a child and they don't know what to do, we can love, that we can show that there are people who care, that we can be the kind of people, not only by our resources, but people who welcome strangers into our homes and so genuinely love. We value relationships, which is another one of our values as a church, because when we're radically generous, what we show is that we are for people and not against them. We display that the commands of God are good and for life and for flourishing, and that we want them to grow into all that God intends them to be. This is why I said the commands, the law, is not antithetical to grace. That through the law we see demonstrations of grace because it is rooted in grace. And so in the same way, verses 13 to 16 talk about how we should treat people. So people who have physical disabilities or those who are socially disadvantaged, those who can't defend for themselves, they need to be treated as full and equal partners in society. And so when we treat people as image bearers, made in the image of God, hurt by sin, affected by a world, corrupt by evil, a world that abuses power, when we recognize that and we don't pretend and we deal with people in honesty, when we don't lie but are full of truth and speak love and work for the good of others, we see that the commands of God are not only for our good, but they're for the good of the world. How can it not be for the flourishing of others when you're honest and truthful and defending the cause of those who are weak and needy? So in order to love, we have to know God's devotion to us. We have to see that His commands are good for us and good for the world, because the last thing that I want us to see is from verses 17 and 18, the goal is love. And if the goal of the law is love, then what's the command? Love. The guiding principle of the law, Paul says it in 1 Timothy 1. Jesus mentions it in Matthew 22. It is summed up in this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the law. That's the law. The essence of it. And this idea of loving God and loving neighbor is, it's rooted in verses 17 and 18, which are full of parallels, which I want us to see because there are some very practical implications in verses 17 and 18 for us. Let's look at verses 17 and 18. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. These two verses are parallel to one another. The first phrase matches in verse 17, matches the first phrase in verse 18, the second in verse 17 to the second in verse 18. And there are these concepts that are held together and contrasted. And the first, I want us to see three things of the goal of love. And it's that there are three things that I want us to see. First, hate and love are contrasted. Hate is actually defined in this passage as wanting vengeance. When we want to get even, when we want another's harm, that is hate. Hate is not disagreeing with someone. Hate is, I want to destroy you. I want to ruin your character. I want to ruin your life. I want to ruin you physically. This is the nature of biblical hate. It understands that there is the destruction of another person. And so what we want is the other person's harm. We don't wish them well. We want them to suffer. We want them to feel pain. And we can do this in a couple of ways. The first way that we as human beings love to inflict vengeance is by what I call avoidance. The act of avoidance is me withdrawing my presence so as to punish you. I won't bless you with my presence. I'll ignore you. I'll treat you as though you don't exist. I won't give you the time of day. I avoid you. This is an act of destruction of life and of hatred. If I don't want your good, then what do? I avoid you. Now I need to make one little distinction here, and that is there are cases where people are abusive and they are hurtful. And avoidance in those cases is not hatred, but rather it is an understanding of I put up boundaries and proper limitations. So I don't want us to confuse, in cases where there are abuses of authority, that avoidance in some cases is actually an act of love. But when avoidance is done because I don't want to deal with you ever, and I just wish that you were gone, it is moving from a heart of hatred. Rather than dealing with you, I don't show you life. I don't show you joy. I act in vengeance by punishing you. I cut you off. I cut you out of my life. So I avoid, but the other way is I attack. We do this quite often. We verbally assassinate someone. We just launch all sorts of words, which is why back in verse 16, you notice it says not to be a slanderer among the people. That there is this understanding that there are ways to destroy people while they still live without ever touching them. And it is an act of hatred. That wanting someone's harm is wishing their life away. We can speak poorly of them. We can call into question their motives, their character, their judgment. We can lash out in anger, call names, belittle, mock, or physically harm. They are all the forms of attacking. And vengeance may take many forms, but it is always rooted in avoidance or attack. Love, on the other hand, if you notice, what does it want? It wants the person's good, and it's prepared to suffer for their good. It's the kind of suffering that goes through sleepless nights, knowing that you have to have a hard conversation. It's the kind of suffering that understands, I might be misunderstood. It's the kind of difficulty that says, I want you to flourish in Jesus Christ. Love doesn't mean I affirm every decision or desire that you have. I can disagree with you and love you. Because it's not rooted
in what you want, but it is rooted in my desire and my motive. When you understand that my motive is that I want you to flourish, then suddenly we can start to look at people through a gracious lens. If we see that what their desire is for our good, then we can be slow to judge. We can be patient. We can be gentle. Love says, I want what's best for you, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes so that you flourish and grow. So the first contrast is love versus hate. But the second is that motive and action are inextricably linked and connected. You notice how the passage starts in verse 17? Excuse me. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor. In verse 18, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor. Hatred comes from the heart, we're told. And it's shown in bearing a grudge, holding on to the past, remembering someone's wrongs, counting it against them, never giving them another opportunity. That's not saying we don't set boundaries and limitations. We do. But in setting boundaries and limitations, we also understand that we are seeking to restore the relationship. Love, especially among Christians, remembers that we are family. Notice the language that's used in both verse 17 and 18. You shall not hate your brother. Verse 18, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people. There is a recognition that, especially as Christians, we're family. And the way that family ought to function, the ideal, is not holding grudges and bitterness, but rather learning to live together in forgiveness and love. And so this language of brother and the sons of your own people is remembering that we're family and that we want the best for one another. So we act for the good of our family. But that means we have to answer the question, how do we do that? Well, that comes up in the third. There is a connection and interaction. There's actually a command. Each phrase in verse 17, as I said, it's paralleled with one in verse 18. And the way that we love others as we love ourselves in verse 18 is paralleled with the phrase in verse 17, you shall reason frankly with your neighbor. There is nothing more loving and generous and honoring than having a face-to-face conversation with someone. Don't send an email. Please don't. Don't offer criticisms in an email. If you can't do it in person, it's not loving. Reason frankly. The concept of reasoning actually has the idea of a dialogue. It means that you have ideas, that you speak and the other person responds, and that you together dialogue back and forth. One way speeches and monologues of telling someone how faulty they are is not love. Reason frankly. Love your neighbor. And the reason I say that we ought to, as often as we can, do this in person, there is a time and a place to do it in written form, as the apostles do, but always the apostles, in their letters, when they write, as John can say in, I think it's 2nd or 3rd John, though I write these things to you with pen and ink, I long to see you face to face. Paul says, when I come to you, I will reason with you, he says to the Corinthians. That the goal of Christians is to interact with a dialogue one to another. Because you know what happens when I have to have that hard conversation and I have to look at you in the eye? I get to see how you respond. I see if you're angry. I see if my words hurt you. I see the pain that it causes. I see the way that I need to be understanding and sympathetic. I've made this mistake way too many times in doing correspondence with people and offering criticism in electronic or written form, and I so hate it, and I so regret it. We don't let sin build up because we don't want to meet. That's hatred. But I think I can honestly say, if I've ever sat down with someone face to face, I've never walked away with more hatred in my heart. When I have to see your face, when you tell me that I've done something wrong, And then you understand my motives or my wrong actions. When you hear my heart, when you see my body language, when we respond face to face, when we reason frankly with one another, we're not indirect, we're not hiding behind other pretenses. We're actually speaking the truth in love, as Paul says in Ephesians 4. We see that the opportunity for restoration and reconciliation and redemption, though it feels hard when we go into those things, it is, I've never been disappointed, and I have never walked out of a situation like that going, I hate them. I just haven't. I have to face them. I've never said, that was a total waste of time. They're an idiot. Anything that indicates there's a huge problem with me. The probably the barrier in the relationship is that I have not been willing to reason frankly, having that back and forth dialogue. I've always been encouraged and filled with compassion and love and grown in appreciation for others when I've had to do it face to face. I understand them better and they understand me. They can see and hear in the tone of my voice and in my body language. I want their good and I can see that they want mine. I can't make them an enemy because they're not an object on a screen that I can just click and send off a message, but rather I see that they're a real person. And I trust that God has so loved me so I can reason to understand with them and persuade them, my neighbor, they can be better for it, and so will I. When I met Phil and Karen, these poor beat up missionaries, they didn't look like anything spectacular. Over the years, Philip and Karen became like parents to Melanie and me. This man had been beat up by abusive leadership. He had been really hurt badly. My first Sunday, 23 years old as a pastor, and he shows up. What began as him just showing up as a beat-up former missionary actually became the foundation for, well, he was like a father to me in many ways. First, it just started with him seeing that I needed to get outside a little more, and so he'd invite me to cut the trails with him in the bush. And then it was, let's go skiing. There's cross-country ski trails that you helped cut, so you better go enjoy them. Dinners, hot cocoa, babysitting. He became a fellow elder. And over the years, we sat together. We sat together in some pretty excruciating circumstances. We sat together as we watched a marriage fall apart, as we pleaded with a couple not to get divorced, knowing the pain that was about to result. We sat with people who had committed adultery, saw forgiveness and repentance. He was a medical doctor, and so some of my medical appointments actually turned into elder meetings. There were a few times where they turned into strategizing sessions. Coffee was always a joy. And you know, when there was no one else to talk to, Philip was there. As men, one of the things that Philip taught me was we could have sharp disagreements. And we did. But we also had moments of deep confession and prayer. And it was one of the best things in my life. And when I left Northwestern Ontario, one of the hardest moments was saying goodbye to Philip. I just saw him recently in Indianapolis, and it was a joy to see him, father figure. On my last Sunday, when I left the church in Emo, Philip shared something with me that has stayed with me, and it has made me understand Leviticus 19 unlike anything else. He said, Andrew, that first Sunday, I was hurt. But I came and I saw a young guy full of poise and promise.
Not a lot of experience, but a lot of desire. And I vowed in my heart that I would do everything to make you succeed. And he did. He set apart time. He devoted himself to me. He worked for my good. I experienced the law of love, the love of God, through that man. I saw that the commands were good for me. I don't know if you have a Philip in your life. I sure hope that you do. And if you don't, I hope that you are a Philip to someone. That you can show, as Jesus says, that the law is fulfilled in the law of love. And that by loving others, we exceed, far exceed, any demand that was ever required. For in this, you know life, and you know love, and you know that when God is for you, nothing can be against you. And when you are for someone, nothing will be against that person when you so love them.